Hello and welcome to the Royal Society Art Science Podcast. This episode features the latest highlights from the Royal Society. My name's Stephen.
And I'm Alison. Last month, the Royal Society opened its doors to the public as part of the Open House London exhibition, the capital's biggest architectural festival, giving visitors the opportunity to have guided tours around the iconic Carlton House Terrace. Located at numbers 6 to 9 on the terrace, the Royal Society's striking facade was designed by Regency architect John Nash and conceals the stories left behind by many occupants since its completion in 1829. Numbers 7, 8 and 9 were once the location of the German embassy, and number 9 saw the signing of the papers that declared the outbreak of World War I. The Third Reich German ambassador departed in 1939, and after World War II, the houses were used by the Foreign Office before falling into disrepair. A yellowing newspaper recently unearthed in the Royal Society's archives even revealed that the empty building was once occupied by partying beatniks in the 60s, before the current occupants, the Royal Society, moved in 1967.
As part of the open house celebrations, we had Sarah Dry give a lecture about the private life of Isaac Newton. In her book, The Newton Papers, Sarah tells the strange story of Newton's massive papers after he died. Lost for hundreds of years in the hands of heirs and scientists, the collection of 10 million words finally uncovered. I interrupted Sarah in her pre-lecture preparation for a little talk. I read that you've got a PhD in history and philosophy of science, but I've not seen anywhere that you actually call yourself Dr. Dry.
I don't.
No.
I mean, well, I'm not a practicing academic. I call myself a writer and an independent scholar because I'm independent. I made the decision to spend my time writing books that hopefully will reach a wider audience than most scholarly books do. Because that's what I'm passionate about, is communicating science to as many people as possible. I don't think science should just be the preserve of specialists, be it historians or scientists. So one of the great things about this book, the Newton Papers, is that it covers a long period of time, you know, much longer time than normally you would do in a scholarly work. You know, starts with Newton's death in 1727 and comes more or less up to the present.
So your talk this afternoon, it's called...
The Private Life of Isaac Newton. So, and so really what it's about is what can we understand about the private man through his papers. And I guess it's also about why is it important? Why do we always feel it's important to understand the private man? And that impulse also has a history. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what I write about in the book, and part of what has interested me is when did it become important, urgent, titillating to think about what a man writes in private versus what a man makes public. And I think today we tend, although things are getting quite blurry, the line between private and public is complicated as ever, but we tend to think that somehow the privacy has, somehow because it's intimate, it has a certain truth to it. But you could think of it in a different way, that when we choose to make something public, we're making an active choice, and we're sharing it with the world because we say, this says something about who I am.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't think it's either or.
What actually got you involved with Newton?
Well, it's a great story that hasn't been told yet. And as a writer, you're always looking for great stories that haven't been told. And if they're about the greatest scientist that ever lived, so much the better. And the thing about Newton is people love, you know, when I told them I was writing this book, a lot of times people would say, oh yeah, wasn't he crazy? Didn't he go crazy? Or what? Didn't he do alchemy? And what? Didn't he have these crazy religious beliefs? And so it's not that people don't know some of this, but it's what interested me was that there's always this tension between what we think Newton should be, this sort of great man of science that we've sort of heard about in this mythic way with not maybe always knowing exactly why he was so great.
Yeah.
But people really love this notion that there's another side. And so that's been a recurrent feature of the way people have understood Newton since his death. That's not a 21st century phenomenon. That's an 18th, 19th, 20th century phenomenon.
I also read that about that Newton only laughed twice. So that's written down somewhere that he...
Well, there's only two recorded instances
when he
laughed. Yeah, which is saying something. I mean, I think... Yeah. There was one nice anecdote where someone was asked, you know, who knew Newton, is it true that he didn't, you know, that he was quite a serious man? And he said, well, I didn't see him laugh very much, but he could occasionally smile, you know, which tells you something. I mean, I think, he was quite a serious-minded person, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, this image of Newton as this kind of solitary, mad genius. Well, there is evidence for that in the sense that sometimes he forgot to come down to eat when he was working on a problem, especially as a young man. There is evidence for that, but later in his life, he comes to London. He spends the last three decades of his life in London, in the midst of the political and social world of London, and does a lot of socializing and entertaining. So he's by no means a hermit. You know, Newton spent his very long lifetime, he was 84 when he died, which was very, very old for the time, pretty much doing writing, studying and writing. I mean, he did serve as a master of the mint for three decades, so we can't underestimate that. But even in that capacity, he's writing. So he's really a scholar for his life. So he has this time to build up this incredible archive of materials. And then what's fascinating is that for a variety of quite different reasons, he chooses to make very little of it public. Mm-hmm. Of course, he makes his great work, the Principia Mathematica, public first in 1687, and then subsequently revises it two times. So, you know, and he's quite eager to make it clear that this is his domain over which he has complete dominion, this revolutionizing approach to understanding not just our world, not just our solar system, but the whole universe. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of amazing thing that is universal gravitation. So he does that, and he does the optics, which is also his claim to fame in the study of light and color.
If you want to know more about the private life of Newton, then go to the events page to find a full audio recording of the lecture. Alternatively, why not check out Sarah Dry's book, The Newton Papers?
Up next, we have a topic so hot that it takes place in the sun. Katrina Ross spoke to Dr. Inika de Mortel and Professor Philippa Browning, organisers of the Theo Murphy International Scientific Meeting, New Approaches in Coronal Heating.
So I'm Philippa Browning. I'm a professor of astrophysics at the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics at the University of Manchester. And I do research in plasma physics, particularly the solar corona, theoretical modelling, and of course coronal heating, which is the subject of our meeting here.
Inika de Mortel, I'm a professor in applied mathematics at the School of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of St Andrews. And just like Philippa, I do research on the sun, mainly the sun's outer atmosphere, why it is so hot, how that energy is stored and released in the atmosphere.
So could one of you tell me why you're here today and what coronal heating is?
Okay, we've organised this meeting on coronal heating because it's one of the major outstanding problems in astrophysics. In fact, it turns out that it's 75 years since we've known about this problem, because it was way back in 1939 that they realised that the temperature of the corona was actually over 1,000,000 degrees compared with the surface temperature of the sun, which is only a few thousand. And this is really quite surprising because obviously the sun is hot in the middle, the energy is transferred outside, you might expect it just to get cooler and cooler as you go away from the centre. And in fact, quite remarkably, it gets hotter and hotter. And although there's been a lot of progress in the intervening years, we still don't really know the answer to this problem, and that's why we've had this meeting.
Okay, well, coronal heating is obviously interesting because the sun is so near as a star, it's our star, and as Philippa said, as you move away from the surface, you eventually get to the Earth, and there is no significant boundary anywhere. So it's interesting to think we live inside this hot atmosphere, and all the dynamics that go on there obviously affect the Earth. But more than that, the sun is obviously not the only star, and it's certainly not the only star with a hot atmosphere. So trying to understand it at the sun, where we can make observations in some detail, will hopefully help us understand it for other stars as well eventually.
At this meeting, we've been hearing a lot about recent developments on this subject. There's a huge amount coming out from recent observations, particularly from space. We have a lot of telescopes in space which are looking at the sun, for example, Solar Dynamic Observatory, SDO, which looks particularly at the hot plasma in the corona, but we also have recently IRIS looking much more at the cooler stuff, which turns out to be quite important. And at the same time, we've got a lot of theoretical work. We're learning a lot from big computer simulations, and we're also learning a lot from more simple mathematical models which try to get the essence of what's going on. And at this meeting, we've been trying to really put all that together and see what the latest developments are.
So do you think there's going to be some exciting developments from this meeting?
I think we certainly hope that's one of the aims of this meeting, was to get all these different parts of our community to really talk to each other, learn from each other. You know, what can the observations or the observers learn from the models, from the theoreticians, You know, can they observe variables that then can limit our models, that can be used as input for our theoretical models? And the other way around, of course, as well, you know, can the theoreticians and the modelers tell the observers what they need to look at? What observable quantities can they predict that then can be measured? So we're hoping to really get people in touch with each other and talk to each other.
To follow such heat, let's go to the cold and serious issue of Arctic sea ice reduction. Near the end of September, the Royal Society hosted the discussion meeting, Arctic Sea Ice Reduction, the Evidence, Models and Global Impacts, as an informal forum for scientists. One of the organisers was Dr. Sheldon Bacon. Sheldon currently resides in Southampton and is part of the National Oceanography Centre. He received his PhD from Southampton University in 1996 and is now Associate Head of the Marine Physics and Ocean Climate Group. Chloe McIver spoke to Sheldon.
So could you give a bit of a summary about what the meeting's been about and what you have hoped to achieve?
Yeah, so the Arctic is probably the fastest warming part of the planet. There's a process called Arctic amplification that is emerging from the noise now, so we can see it happening. We need to understand how the Arctic works better than we do at the moment, so this is an opportunity. This meeting has been an opportunity for scientists to get together and see what we know and what we still need to find out.
So what are some of the most interesting things you've heard people discussing?
Yeah, that's always a tricky one, because it's kind of a technical meeting. It's kind of focused on sea ice, so there are whole other meetings to be held that talk about the ocean in its own right, the atmosphere in its own right, and the contributions of the land as well, because the land deliver a huge amount of water to the system, which changes the ocean and ice dynamics. So having said what the meeting's not about, the things that kind of intrigued me were taking apart climate models and seeing which bits do what jobs in the northern high latitudes. That was one thing that I found really interesting. That was the thing I liked, I think.
Okay. So what is the general discussion occurring about Arctic sea ice? What's the situation looking like?
So what does it look like? Well, it's kind of well known, I think, that the ice covered area has been declining dramatically in recent decades. We have pretty good records for the satellite era, which starts in 1979. It's getting smaller in summer and it's getting thinner pretty much all the time. The best models, best prediction is that we might get reliably ice-free summers in 30, 40, 50 years' time, perhaps, and reliably, you know, you've got to have a definition that goes with that. I mean, sustained for perhaps 5 years as a minimum. Ice-free, meaning there's probably never going to be none, like none as in totally zero. So you define it as a very low but still positive value, like maybe a million square kilometres, something like that. So you've got a metric, you've got to have something you can gauge this kind of statement against, and that's a manageable definition.
So I understand this afternoon some people will be talking about the impacts,
yeah,
about, you know, on weather and things like that.
Absolutely. There's a great talk coming up by a fine scientist called Jennifer Francis. It's an absolutely fascinating and very credible hypothesis if anyone in Britain is reading this. Or actually, it works for America as well. Reading, did I say? Listening to this. The last few winters and springs in Britain have been really weird. I think it was 2010, 2011, we had huge dumps of snow in December, big impacts on, you know, like Heathrow Airport. The main London airport was shut for a week or more. There was immense flooding. Was it last spring or spring before last? Sustained rainfalls. And this is what you expect if the atmospheric circulation pattern goes kind of more wavy and floppier, essentially. It slows down the circulation of weather systems that track across the Atlantic and end up usually in Britain. They can be the same kind of weather system, the same sort of size and intensity, but they can move more slowly. And if there happens to be high pressure over the continent, which there always is from time to time, over Europe that is, then these weather systems can stall, they can just park. And you end up getting these sustained localized precipitation events. So if it's raining, it just keeps raining in the same place instead of trundling off down the road. likewise, the flip side of that are the droughts and the sustained dry weather that you see. It's like the other side of the same kind of wave pattern, if you like, where we're getting extra rain through stalling of weather systems. They're getting the other side of the front, if you like, where it just keeps on going dry. So it's a pattern and a feature that stands to affect weather in a lot of the Northern Hemisphere, and it's probably something to do with the Arctic. You can think of it as like a bowstring. If you imagine that the temperature difference from like where I'm standing now in about 50 north in London up to the Arctic, the temperature difference is like tension in a bowstring. And instead of firing arrows, you're firing depressions across the North Atlantic. And if you slacken the tension in the bowstring, so you warm the Arctic, then you're just basically firing the arrows. The depressions are moving more slowly because the string's slacker. So it's that's a kind of a plain language version of what I think Jennifer's going to talk about in a minute.
Last month's Our Science podcast was a summer science exhibition special. However, this month Stephen caught up with exhibition volunteer Shamari Lewis-Wilson to talk about his experience as a volunteer.
I understand that you're in your final year of a neuroscience degree at the University of Nottingham. So why neuroscience?
Well, I've always had an interest in the complex functioning of the brain and felt that a neuroscience degree was like the perfect match for the parts of biology and psychology that I like and interested me most in college.
Nice, that sounds like a perfect mix of the two subjects for you. I have to admit though, neuroscience to me sounds pretty complex. So what made you decide to use your valuable time to volunteer at the Summer Science Exhibition?
Well, a lot of my other like colleagues in my tutor group had like some fantastic different like work experience opportunities coming up for them for summer.
Yeah.
So I chose to do a volunteer work at the Royal Society for the Summer Science Exhibition this year because I like interacting with people and wanted to get more experience in the field of public engagement, which organisations like the Royal Society in particular do quite a lot.
That's a really good idea. It's something that I should have done looking back at it. Thinking about science and public engagement, with the variety that goes on at the Summer Science Exhibition, it must have been a really good environment for you to flex your public engagement muscle. Can you tell me about the work that you did?
Yeah, most definitely. Well, my role at the exhibition revolved around supporting some of the other members of staff at the Royal Society to ensure that this year's exhibition was better than all the previous year's ones, in showcasing some of the best research that's around in the UK and also around the world. This involved helping to coordinate the school groups and school shows that we presented, as well as monitoring the number of people, as over 2,500 students and 248 teachers this year, the biggest ever, were on site across the week. So my responsibilities included briefing the students on what the Royal Society is about, and also as well as being on hand to answer any questions for the students, teachers and other members of the public.
That sounds like a lot of students, and it must have felt really rewarding to work with
Indeed.
Those students.
Yeah.
The Summer Science Exhibition will have been great for you to work on your communication and management skills. But what has been the best outcome for you volunteering?
Well, it's been a great opportunity to like rejuvenate my interest in science in general, because after working so hard for exams at university, you kind of lose track sometimes of what really like, you know, you're in university for. So it definitely gave me a new lease of life to how, you know, my interest in science in the first place. Previously, I would never have considered like doing scientific research or like policy making, but now those things seem quite exciting to me. So I'm looking forward to getting into my final year so I can kind of see a bit more of those different angles. And plus, as I've said before, it gives me some really cool things to say to tell my tutor.
I always struggled with that. I'm really pleased that it's rejuvenated you with science. It's kind of a core part to your studies. Do you know what your final year project will be on?
Yes, my final year project is in an area very close to what the Royal Society does, as I'll be doing some public engagement of my own at some primary schools in Nottingham.
Great.
So I hope to transfer some of the communication skills that I've learned here at the Royal Society to do this, and I can't wait for the challenge.
If you want to know more about the Summer Science Exhibition, check out last month's podcast.
Finally, for this episode, we bring you our monthly Why Science. This month, it comes from Sarah Dry, who we heard earlier talking about the private life of Isaac Newton.
Science is the most important, I think, aspect of modern culture today. And if you think about power, if you think about the way we live on a daily basis. And that's why I think it's vital that science is something that each and every person feels a relationship to, an ownership of, that it's understood that science isn't an activity that's undertaken by an elite that's separate, but it's an activity that's embedded in the life of a community, a city, a nation, and that as a society we make decisions about how we're going to fund it, what our values mm-hmm. are in terms of it. So, I mean, I'm really passionate about bringing stories of science that have a kind of immediacy that people can relate to life on the page.
That's all for this month. Next time we'll be covering the Writing Wrongs event, Café Scientifique and the political party conferences. See you then.